Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:30 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is July 7th. And I think one of the markets that made the most highlights today was silver. It was trading around the $16 level at the close yesterday, and it hit a low today of $14.34, and that happened within seconds. It is the first major big drawdown that we've seen in silver in a couple of years, and it is interesting from the perspective of where we are in terms of the medium-term trend, because silver has lost about a quarter of its value in the last 12 months, going from about $20 down to 15 and change right now. If we go back and we look at what happened at the low back in 2014, then this was also a pretty deleterious time. There is the world of difference, I think, in terms of what it does to market sentiment when you get a flash crash after a big run-up and when you get one after a big decline. Because at a big decline and you get a very large tail on the candle at the bottom, what does that tell us? It really means that we've seen an acceleration of the declining trend. That was certainly evident in silver today. And what does that then do? It puts a great deal of pressure on some of the weaker holders who would have had stops in the market. All those stops would have been triggered. Any of the speculative buyers who would have had automatic buys under the market below $15, then those were actioned, and that's where the demand that came in to push it back up. That's a substantial tail on the candle, and we're back in the region of the lows that have been in evidence since really 2014. So this is a substantial lengthy range which has been really quite volatile, both on the upside and the downside. The most important characteristic right now is that silver hold that low around the $14.50 level, and that represents a dollar of potential downside from where prices are closing today. But if we were to in the tick To take the completely contrarian view and to think, well, perhaps this is the low, and maybe we're going to get some upside follow-through on Monday. Well, then it would, if we get a move back above $16, then this would represent a failed downside break and potentially the low of the move. So what happens in silver over the next few days is going to be really quite important, and it's also important what happens with gold, because gold prices were down $12 today, and more importantly, they have broken now the progression of higher reaction lows since the end of middle of December of last year. And that means that it really is all for the bulls to prove. That's despite the fact that prices are off by almost $100 since the middle of June, and that this is already a fairly substantial pullback, that there is a short-term oversold condition. But markets can go oversold and stay oversold, and that means then that what we need to see is a clear upper dynamic to confirm that demand is coming back to dominance in this area. Something akin to what we saw back in March would be the best possible scenario from the perspective of the bulls, but it is certainly for the bulls to prove now. And I think a sustained move now above the $1,230 level would be required to break this 6-week progression of lower rally highs. This is a key moment for gold, because if we look at it on that weekly chart, there has been an upward bias for the last 6 months, but it hasn't been able to regain the peak that we saw in the middle of last year. This is a very rangy, choppy environment following what had been a very firm period in the beginning of 2016, and the big question now is the $1,200 area going to hold, and are we going to move into a much more volatile environment where the $1,100 level could get opened up for a test, or indeed the $1,000 level. So this is a pivotal time for gold and also for silver, because if this represents a breakdown, if silver were to decline even further next week, then we are in the they were opening up the possibility that lower levels are going to get tested. So this is really a pivotal time for the precious metals. Platinum prices are back around at the $900 level, and $900 has represented an area of support just about all year. But when we look at it on the weekly chart, we can see that there is a downward bias, and that it is really that $900 level has to hold, or it's going to open up the potential for the $800 level to be tested. What is interesting at the current moment is that palladium prices are closing in on platinum prices. Palladium is currently around $836, and it was in positive territory today. That's despite the fact that it has been pulling back over the last few weeks, and that is unwinding the short-term overbought condition. And $900 has represented an area of resistance since at least 2011. So this is a natural area where it would encounter resistance, but a break below the 200-day moving average would be required to question the potential for palladium to continue to outperform. And despite the fact that the automotive sector is plagued by these uncertainties with regard to automation and electric vehicles, and also from declining sales, there is the additional point that the vast majority of catalytic converters employ palladium. And if palladium prices are trading above the price of platinum for any kind of sustained period, then that will increase the argument for a retooling, and that could act as a bullish catalyst for platinum prices. So I think we are at an interesting juncture when you look at the spread between the two commodities and what that might mean for their relative pricing to one another, because palladium hasn't been more expensive than platinum in a very long time, and I think it's more than a decade. When we go back and think about where are we in terms of this long-term cycle? This has been really rather an eventful week, and I think it is worth looking at the Dow Gold ratio. Hold on, that's not the right one. There we go. And I need to go much longer than that. There we go. So the Dow Gold ratio has been trending higher since, and I really need to go much, much longer. I don't know why it hasn't, why that chart isn't showing me exactly what I wanted. So we can see that it hit a very important peak back in 2000. It hit an equally important trough in the beginning of 2014. Or excuse me, that's 2012. The end of 2012, where the low was somewhere around 7.5, and it is now at 17.6. These are very long-term patterns, and when we think about these very long-term patterns, they give us a graphic representation of one asset class outperforming another for a secular period of time, and then the relationship reversing, and one asset class underperforming the other for a secular period of time. And 1999 to 2012 was a 12-year bull market for gold relative to the Dow Jones. And now we're back in a period where equities are likely to outperform gold. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be year in, year out where equities will outperform gold, but the long-term trend is likely set in place, that it has already been in place for 5 years, and if we look back at history, then the length of time between peaks, between the peak of outperformance of equities relative to gold, then it is in the region of 36 years. That would suggest that if the last peak was in 1999, then the next peak will be sometime in around 2035, and give or take a couple of years on either side of that estimate. We are currently in 2017, and therefore there is the bones of 20 years of potential outperformance of equities relative to gold, and that could potentially see this ratio going to new all-time highs, which would be above 40, and it is currently at 17. Therefore, that would suggest that between now and 2035, the Dow Jones is either going to double or gold is going to halve, or both, or at some similar relationship between the two. And that is probably means that we should be looking at what the Dow Jones looks like right now. This week we had Ray Dalio coming out and saying that he thinks that the party that has been thrown by central banks over the last 7 years is over, and that you have to keep dancing, but you should be dancing closer to the door. And I guess that's an allusion to Chuck Prince's quip from when he was CEO of Citibank before the financial crisis, saying as long as the music is still playing, we'll keep dancing. But that's one set of, I guess that's one way of thinking about the market. Then you had Jeff Gundlach out this week saying that he thought that yields are going to go up a lot more. That and then you had David Rosenberg saying that he thought that 2.4% was the near-term hurdle, but it was very unlikely that the yield was going to go above 2.6% because deflationary risks are still so high. So we are in an environment where there is a great deal of disagreement, and what's quite difficult from the perspective of investors is that it is that these arguments are really quite cogent. That we can argue that valuations have gone up a lot. We can argue that there is a lot of leverage in the system. We can argue that home sales have started to slow down, auto sales have slowed down, and capital expenditure is slowing down. So then that would suggest that this is not the most impressive economic expansion that anyone has ever seen. So those are all true. And it is really then a question of what is going to be our conclusion based upon all of these often contrasting facts. Well, the thing that we have to bear in mind is that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. That we have been through a period of extraordinarily lax monetary policy, and that means that it has contributed to this asset price inflation. What happens with the ECB is perhaps more important than what happens with any other central bank right now, because it has been the ECB has been the primary supplier of liquidity to the global markets for the last few years. They flirted with reducing the size of their balance sheet between 2012 and 2014, and it was a rather heroic attempt to unwind a quantitative easing program. And what it contributed to was a very sharp deflationary outcome for a number of those European markets. So they had to reverse course, and the net result of that reversing course was that the size of their balance sheet doubled. They have now begun to achieve the economic growth and asset price inflation that the US was able to achieve when they adopted quantitative easing almost a decade ago. But the question now is whether the ECB is going to start tapering that largesse. And that is a very large question. That is part of the reason why. Let me just type in the ticker for the German Bund. German bunds were breaking out, the yield was breaking out this week. As recently as the end of 2016, investors were paying Germany for the privilege of giving them their money. And that was a rather ridiculous set of circumstances. And that kind of contradiction, that you can pay somebody to take your money and still expect to get a positive return, that is about as clear a contradiction as anyone might anticipate from the top of a market. It's very unlikely that those negative yields are going to be repeated in Germany. And because Germany was the greatest beneficiary of the ECB's largesse, that's where we have some of the greatest potential for downside within this market, if indeed the ECB follows through and begins to taper its monetary policy. It's still a long way off that before the ECB even begins to raise interest rates. because they're not going to raise interest rates as long as they are still adding liquidity into the market. So they'll have to taper first and raise interest rates afterwards. And that still represents a significant amount of time. Of course, that's not how leverage works. Leverage works on having the most possible exposure you can at any one time. So when situations change, positions become really quite susceptible, and that has contributed to some of the volatility that we've had in just the last few weeks, and not least in very high momentum shares that are acutely reliant on momentum. And Tesla falls into that category because there are a significant number of shares that did spectacularly well from the beginning of this year, but not all of them have no earnings. And Tesla has only turned a profit in one quarter in the last few years. They've been racking up losses, and now there are questions both about their ability to meet their production schedule, and also for the Model 3, and then also that once they hit 200,000 vehicles, they're going to lose the access to the subsidies that they've enjoyed. So there are some rather large questions, and not least that to fund the additional production capacity that they require to meet all those orders for the Model 3, they may have to issue additional shares. So this has been a pretty sharp pullback. And there is competition rising. Because Tesla has been the company to beat, people are rising to the challenge. So Volvo and Volkswagen are coming in, and so is Fisker. There was an announcement at the beginning of this week that Fisker has a car that they're beginning to take pre-orders for, that they hope to have out sometime later this year, that will go 400 miles on a charge and will be able to charge for a 100-mile range within 9 minutes. And now that's a car that's going to cost $110,000, but irrespective of that, that represents a considerable leap in technology from the perspective of Tesla. So the number of items that are stacking up against the share are increasing. But the most important one is that it is a highly leveraged share that has been pulling back as we have had a catalyst coming through of greater hawkishness from central banks. I think it really does mean that we should be keeping a close eye on what's happening with the US Treasury market. US Treasuries have the yield has pushed up over the last 2 weeks. It is now testing the 2.4% level, and that represents the region of the progression of lower rally highs for most of this year. But within the context of the decade-long trend, the yield has been ranging for 5 years already. And there was a good part of that range happened on the downside between about 2014 and the middle of 2016. And the yield has now bounced from the region of the trend mean. I've been to a number of Jeff Gundlach's talks, and he is a technical analyst, and I suspect that when he says that he thinks that yields are going higher from here, it's because the yield has bounced from the region of the trend mean, and that the base is already well established at this stage, that there was a clear downside break in the middle of 2016, and that raises the possibility that we're going to go right back up and test the upper side of the range, which is around 3%. So from a technical perspective, that is certainly possible. But in order to confirm that that is realistic, it is at least going to have to take out the 2.4%, and that's where we are right now. When we think about what are the potential outcomes, when you look at what Ray Dalio is saying, when you look at what Rosenberg is saying, and what Gundlach is saying, then there is a potential outcome that would make all three of them correct. And it is that economic growth picks up, that the central banks believe that inflation is going to become a problem, and they start raising interest rates. Because economic growth is picking up, that is translated into additional upside for stock markets. But that the higher interest rates go, the greater the potential is that that's going to have an impact on the liquidity situation, and that will eventually roll over into some of the things that have benefited most from more liquidity running into trouble, and then that will create the next recession. So that would suggest that this has been an incredibly impressive, almost decade-long advance. We're in the middle of 2017, and the leading markets started bottoming in late 2008, and the wider market bottomed in early 2009. This has been the longest expansion in the post-war era. It has not been the most impressive, but when we look at the trend on the S&P, it has been remarkably consistent since the beginning of 2016, and the reactions since the beginning of this year have been in the order of about 50 points. Well, considering just how consistent it is, that it is going to have to pull back by more than 50 points to confirm that we are in a process of mean reversion. And it would have to break below the 200-day moving average to really confirm that we have any evidence at all of a top formation developing. Even the big pullbacks that we saw in 2015 and the beginning of 2016, that was potentially a top formation developing. But we have subsequently seen that it was able to rally back up and move on to new high ground. And it's not unusual that we get a somewhat larger reaction in the middle of a big trend. That now the more likely scenario is that we are in the latter stages of this bull market, but the latter stages of a bull market can last for a few years. And so far, we have to ask very simple questions rather than try to parse the various opinions of different people, because there are really three things that we can see on any chart. This goes right back to the chart seminar and the disciplines that we need to evolve in order to identify where we are in terms of the market cycle and what is the rhythm of the market. But first, we should talk about what are the mistakes that one can really make when looking at charts, because you can see three things on any chart. You can see what you want to see, you can see what you think you're going to see, and you can see what's there. Well, if you have long positions, you're going to want to see that the market continue to go higher. So you will ignore evidence of large drawdowns, or you would ignore evidence of big overextensions. So when we look at this market, we can see that it hasn't pulled back by more than 50 points so far this year. If it does, that will open up the potential for a reversion back to the mean, which from current levels is about 100 points. But 100 points on a 2400 point index is really not an awful lot. Then we can see what we think we're going to see. And considering that we have luminaries within the financial community, people who have been incredibly successful in their careers, telling us very stridently about what they think is going to happen, then it's easy to look at the price action and to see what they are saying is going to happen, rather than to analyze it ourselves. And then there is, of course, we see what's there. But in order to see what's there, we have to address the consistency characteristics. Well, we've talked about the consistency characteristics that we've seen in the S&P 500, but then we have to ask the key question, and that's, is there any evidence of top formation development? And the answer is no. That's really important. More than any other factor, that's the most important thing that we can say. That we can look at all the lead indicators in the world about when the next recession might be, and there's no real evidence that it's going to be any time before the latter half of 2018, and that's the earliest possible it could be, and it could also be in 2019 or 2020. When, and this is, I think, the more important point, we're not going to get a recession without some evidence of top formation development. And what are the three potential top formations? If we know what the trend looks like, then we should be able to script what the ending would look like to a blind person. And when we look at the S&P 500, which is the big cap index in the biggest market, then we can say that this trend is still consistent, and it has been particularly consistent since the beginning of 2016. The three potential trend endings are this. One is acceleration, that the pace of the advance picks up and picks up a lot, and that instead of going from 2000 to 2400 in the space of a year, that it goes from 2400 to 20 or to 3000 in 3 months. That would be an acceleration. That would open up the potential that we are now in a trend-ending phase, because it would be sucking in investors from all over the world. People would throw in the towel. You would no longer hear any expressions of fear or reticence, and that everyone would simply accept the message that this is a powerful bull market and that you should be buying it. So certainly that is the case. That could potentially be the case, but there's no evidence of it yet. There's no evidence of an acceleration. We could have a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We could see a substantial drawdown similar to what we saw in 2015. And the fact that in 2015 you first had that big drawdown, then you had the big run back up, and then it encountered resistance below the previous peak and then pulled back again and made a new low. Well, that was potentially a top formation characteristic, that we had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend in the summer. Then it rallied back up, and we got this period of right-hand extension, or a first step below the peak, and then it pulled back again. If it had followed through on the downside, then it would have been a completed top. It did not, though. So we had the failed downside break below the August lows, and then it pushed right back up again. That was an absolute head fake, and there's no other. From the perspective of a chart reader, it looked like it was going to be a top, and then it wasn't. And so, but that gives us an idea of what a type 2 top might look like, and then we could have a type 3 top, which would be a very volatile, very large trading range. That we pretend they never start out as type 3s, so it would either start with an acceleration or start with a massive reaction and then give way to an extremely volatile ranging environment. But again, there is no evidence of that. So we can look at this market and say it's been going up for a long time, and we're beginning to see the return to outperformance of cyclicals like the mining sector. And when you start to see that cyclicals have been underperforming for a long time and return to a position of outperformance, well, then that generally tells us that we are in a cyclical expansion. And the reason that we're getting so many more, and of course this is the banking sector, and it is also returning to a position of outperformance, well, then these are generally speaking cyclical sectors. When they start performing after a lengthy period of underperformance, then we know that we're in the latter stages of an expansion. But if we just go back and look at some more history, the time when the resources sector, and of course that was in really quite an impressive advance, but what we can also say is that the time when it was really doing best was all the way up to at the end of May in 2008, and that was quite late. That it generally is not going to be the lead indicator for the end of the cycle, whereas the banking sector often is, because the banking sector as a liquidity provider is finely tuned to the amount of liquidity that's in the market. Now that also means that we. The fact that banks are returning to a position of outperformance means that the chances are that this is not the big top, but rather that we are just in a period of potentially mean reversion, and that the shares that are most likely to revert to the mean are those that have got the largest overextensions relative to the mean. When we look at the broader global stock market environment, then the Europe Stoxx 600 is consolidating below 400. But the much bigger point is that it has been ranging below 400 for an awfully long time. And the first time it tested the 400 level was in early 2000. So this just looks like a consolidation in the region of the upper side of a very long-term range. The FTSE 100, aided by the weakness of the pound, has broken up and out of its long-term range just this year, and it continues to be aided by the weakness of the pound. The DAX index has been leading by a considerable margin. It has been among the greatest beneficiaries both of the creation of the EU and the Eurozone, but also from the ECB's largesse. So it was able to break upwards and out of the most recent range quite recently, and now we're getting the first consolidation of that move. And these are very important characteristics because this is the second biggest market anywhere. And then if we look at some of the indices that have been unable to participate in some of the bigger moves out there, they are just now starting to break upwards. So Taiwan has cleared the 10,000 point level for the first time since 1990, and it is still below its 1990, very early 1990 peak. The Korean index experienced a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend in 2011 and spent the next 6.5 years ranging before breaking upwards. And there is news just this week that Samsung Electronics is likely to make a larger profit than Apple in the next quarter. So there are some obviously clear reasons for why it might be beginning to outperform. The Indian index is also breaking on the upside. It is currently in a process of consolidating what has been a very powerful period from the beginning of this year, but the trend is clear that the Indian market continues to represent one of the clearest secular bull market environments, and it is being driven higher by the fact that you have a growth-oriented, democratically elected government that is committed to trying to improve the lot of their billion-plus people. That and that is an example of where governance is improving. There is an additional point, though, that there is something that, for example, Korea, Taiwan, India, and indeed Japan have in common. And it is that they're energy importers. And the fact that the Nikkei, for example, has been able to get up to this 20,000 level on a number of occasions since 1992, but every time it got to that level, it made a new low subsequently. And that has been true for much of the last 20 years, except recently. The last time it got up to the 20,000 level was in 2015. It got down to 15,000, but that was not a new low. And then it is back up to 20,000. This is happening against an environment where energy prices have been coming down, and that is an enormous benefit to particularly to importers of oil. But it also suggests that maybe we're starting to get the whiff of inflation starting to come back in. Because if we're back in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, where China is doing reasonably well, Japan is expanding, Europe is expanding, the US is expanding, and global growth is doing better, which generally speaking tends to boost commodity demand. And if all of that can happen in an environment where energy prices are lower, then that is really quite a beneficial outcome. And when you have that kind of beneficial outcome, and where you're getting back to a period where you have full employment, and where the employment situation is starting to encourage previously absent workers back into the workforce, then there isn't much point in saying, "Oh well, this is an environment where we don't have any inflation." Because all you have to do is look through the figures that there are something like 10,000 people a day retiring because of the baby boomers start reaching retirement age, And if employment is still increasing, it means that there are masses of people coming off the sidelines and into the workforce. Eventually, we're going to reach a point where not only do we have full employment by statistical points, but that we have also exhausted the supply of workers that are either underemployed are available for work. And at that point, you get inflation, and that can happen very quickly. So that is, I think, perhaps why the Fed is talking about raising interest rates. They're trying to reload the interest rate gun because they know that, and surely they do not have, they're not so hubristic to think that every time they start raising rates, they eventually contribute to a recession. We have not banished the boom to bust cycle. There will be a recession at some point in future, and central banks need to have their ammunition ready to help to combat it. So their raising rates is in anticipation of the full employment. But it is potentially that we're going to have this uptick in demand, wage demands, because the cost of living has increased so much. And despite the fact that energy prices have come down and technology is contributing to lower prices for a lot of the things that were counted in the inflation measures, the realities are that health insurance has been going up, education costs have been going up, and insurance premiums for everything have been rising. And this is also against a background where accommodation costs have also been rising. So there is no doubt that the cost of living has been increasing, that people have experienced a reduction in their living standards, and that the rise of populism is I think, a symptom of this dissatisfaction with the breadth of the expansion so far. And the answer to that is wage growth. So I think that eventually we are going to start getting wage growth that will contribute to inflation. And there is no market that will benefit more from inflation than Japan. And I continue to regard this as a bullish pattern. So personally, I'm short the Nasdaq because I think that there is a mean reversion, but probably not much more than that. But the next index I probably buy will be back into the Nikkei, because I think it is the one that probably has some, the developed market that has some of the most upside, primarily because it hasn't done anything for such a long time. So I think that that is certainly one place to keep an eye on. When we think about where oil prices are likely to go, it's a very big question. I think, you know, that there are these very compelling arguments, both bullish and bearish, but the price action is bearish. The price action this year, we have a clear progression of lower rally highs. There is a great deal of variance coming in what people are willing to say. I increasingly hear people saying that one of the re and there was an article actually in the Wall Street Journal today talking about that one of the reasons that oil has been still being able to be pumped at increasing levels in Texas is because of easy funding from Wall Street. But what it doesn't talk about, and I haven't seen statistics on, is just how much hedging went on back in January. The spread in January was incredibly tight between the short and the long end of the curve. And if your cost basis is 55 and dropping towards 50 or even 48, and you can hedge out your exposure at 57, well, then that's what you would do. There was a lot of hedging activity went on in that quite inert period between January and March. And that means that as prices decline, they can continue to drill. Economic growth picking up could help to soak up some of the additional supply on the market. That's certainly true. But there is no shortage of supply, because it isn't just that the shale drilling has reduced its cost of production, but offshore has also reduced the cost of production. And we also have the increasingly important phenomenon of refracking, where they can go back to wells that have gone past their peak production and refrack them. so that, and because you're not drilling a new well, the cost of refracking is a fraction of what it is for new wells. So this is an environment where there is no shortage of supply, and that's normal. We had a decade-long period where prices were very high, and there was trillions of dollars invested in additional supply, and that additional supply is now on the market. And I think that we could be in a volatile, ranging environment with trough-to-peak swings in the region of 100% for the lengthy medium term. So we are in a benign environment right now where economic growth is picking up and inflationary pressures on the commodity side, at least in the energy side, have been relatively modest. But that massive supply story is more an energy story than it is an industrial resources story. The LME, the London Metals Exchange Index, has been ranging in a gradual process of mean reversion for almost the, well, it's just about all of this year, and it has bounced from the region of the trend mean. It was a little bit softer this week, but this is still a bullish pattern. It suggests that industrial commodities do not have that massive supply overhang. They're not nearly as political either. And that also feeds through into the return to outperformance of cyclical sectors. And I think that it is the industrial commodities are much more likely to benefit than the energy-related commodities, because I think that oil prices are going to be very volatile for the foreseeable future. So then you have the trend of technological innovation, and it's a complicated one because it is inherently deflationary, but it also contributes to a significant additional economic growth. It contributes to migration of work patterns, and it helps to raise living standards. But of course, what we've also seen with technology is that it also increases your costs. It increases your costs of the kinds of things that you have to own. So, for example, we would have once had a cable bill, but now we have wrapped into the cable bill is your internet, and that's more expensive. You're obviously getting a lot more for it, but you're getting a lot more for it from the discretionary consumable sector rather than what is now a utility. And the utilities are the things you have to pay for every week. You have a mobile phone, which is a new bill. You have to pay that every month. You're getting a lot for it. You're getting a lot of the discretionary spending aspects from it, but you're paying out for it in a utility manner. And that tends to be the kind of way that technology is evolving, that some of the shares that have benefited most that are doing best and have some of the most consistent patterns are adopting subscription models. They are turning what were once discretionary pieces of expenditure into utility type income streams, which then form these necessary pieces of expenditure in both personal and corporate budgets. So we're having this evolution in technology, that technology is becoming a utility type of expenditure for a lot of consumers. And that, because obviously prices for services tend to have more flexibility than prices for hardware. And what we are seeing is that technology is becoming increasingly a service. And I'm curious then as to whether that is going to contribute to inflationary pressures that are not necessarily seem to be measured. So I think that this is a very complicated topic, and there is no one size fits all solution. What we certainly know though is that technology is rapidly improving, and most particularly in terms of programming power. And the kinds of things that are now possible with programming power extend to the transportation sector and to the biotech sector in particular. And the Nasdaq biotech sector has spent much of the last 2 years not doing much of anything, and then it broke out last week. or 2 weeks ago. This is an important breakout, and the fact that it has been sustained despite the uptick in single stock volatility on wider markets, I think that's really quite important. It would suggest that the technology sector, which is also cyclical, that this portion of the technology sector is likely to be one of the leading sectors out of what is a rangy mean reversion phase for the wider market. So if we look at the global picture, and we look at what is happening out there in the world, rather than concentrating on any one particular market, we're still in a bullish environment, that the global economy looks like it is doing well, and that it is natural in that environment for interest rates to rise, that eventually it will contribute to an uptick in inflationary pressures, and that it is natural for interest rates to rise in that environment. The problem, such as it is that the market has become so addicted to liquidity over the last 8 years that it is going to represent a quite significant rotation, and we're already beginning to see the signs of some of that. And not least also that there has been a great deal of volatility in the private sector, where a number of these privately held companies are not receiving the same kind of funding that they were once, and that we're seeing that valuations on some of them, not least Blue Apron that just went public, have come down a lot. So I think that the most important point is that we are still in a benign environment, that interest rates will eventually contribute to a recession, that there's no evidence of it just yet, that we need to be alert to what a top will look like, but again, there is no evidence of it yet. And that the most important thing to watch, I think, are going to be bond yields, because the higher they go, the greater the potential is that the bond market, which is multiples the size of the equity market, is pricing in an inflationary outcome. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.